It's 8:30.
We present In Silver Mist by Mr. Michael Robson, with Mr. Colin Baker as Hugh Dargan, Miss Angela Phillips as Anna Dargan, and Mr. Patrick Malahide as Edmund Powell.
Mr. Dargan?
Mr. Dargan?
I do beg your pardon.
May I help you?
Good morning, sir. My name's Lovelock, Inspector Lovelock of the Wessex Constabulary.
How do you do? It's always pleasant to find a new customer. Was there any particular book you had in mind?
I'm afraid I'm not here to buy, sir, but to ask.
Oh, about what?
It's the matter of Mr. Powell, sir. His disappearance.
Why come to me?
Then you knew the gentleman had vanished.
In a town as small as ours, everyone knows about everything before it's happened.
Yes, very good, Sarah. I must remember that.
I'm glad. And I repeat, why come to me about Pearl's affairs?
Because I understand you're his closest friend.
Now, who the devil led you to understand that?
Well, it's true, sir. Isn't it?
Inspector, I detest Edmund Powell. I detested him for 20 years, and I detest him today.
But I gathered from his wife and from his acquaintances that you and Mr. Powell are the best of friends.
One of Mr. Powell's chief amusements in life is to insist on that very fact. It gives him the keenest pleasure to say so, because he knows it gives me the greatest distress to hear it. Now,
but this is extraordinary, sir. Mrs. Powell has told me that her husband spends all his time singing your praises.
Mrs. Powell is a kindly and gentle lady, and she worships her husband. Anything he cares to tell her, she'll believe.
But if it isn't true, why would he bother to lie about it?
Because he is a liar, and an adulterer, and a drunkard, and a plagiarist. If there be such a thing as spiritual corruption, then Powell revels in it.
These are harsh words, Mr. Dargan.
The truth.
This does put rather a different complexion on matters, of course.
In what respect?
Mr. Powell left his house at about 9 on the evening of November the 21st. He was intending, he told his wife, to have a few drinks with his friends at the Shipwright's Arms. He did not appear at the Shipwright's Arms. He has appeared nowhere since. Did you by any chance see Mr. Powell that evening, sir?
I've already told you I detest the man. Why should I seek him out? I'll be with you in a moment, ma'am.
Thank you.
Can you recall, sir, how you spent the evening and night of the 21st?
Of course I can. I was here.
In the shop, sir?
We close at 7, Inspector. I had an early dinner with my wife, then I went to my room to work.
May one ask the nature of your work, sir?
I compose. In such spare time as I have, I try to compose.
Oh, music, sir, how fascinating. I envy you the creative talent.
Oh, do you? Have you heard any of my work?
I'm afraid I haven't, sir. In my way of business, a man doesn't have too many opportunities to attend concerts and such like. Though I do enjoy a night at the music hall. Very relaxing, I find it.
I'm sure you must, Inspector. Now, is there anything else?
I don't think so, sir. You've been most helpful, and I appreciate that. Oh, there is just one thing.
Yes?
Is Mr. Powell a regular visitor to your shop?
So what did you tell him?
That Powell invades my premises far more than I would wish, but that since it is a public place, and since he does buy books quite regularly, there's nothing I can do about it.
You're looking uncommon low. Another drink.
That's civil, I think I shall.
Saul, a whiskey, please.
And the same amount of water. Thank you, Akers.
What do you think's happened to Powell?
I haven't the remotest idea, and I don't remotely care.
But it is deuced odd, you must admit. Fellow sets off from his house at 9 on Tuesday evening, apparently to come here, then disappears off the face of the earth. Young, healthy, capable. It is deuced odd. Ah, thank you, Saul. Your whiskey, dear boy.
Thank you.
Now, if he'd disappeared after leaving the pub, that I could understand. Pearl, when he sets his mind to it, is a very serious drinker indeed. Appalls me sometimes the quantity he puts away. You've known him far longer than any of us. What do you really think, Hugh?
I've known him and hated him since 1872. 2 full decades, Akehurst. Throwing open the carriage door.
But you look so desperate.
Well, I was looking for an empty compartment. I wanted to be alone this evening.
But now you have company, sir.
Yes. One such as you.
There are tears in your eyes.
What? Oh, forgive me.
You have taken a cold.
Oh, I think not.
Then you are in some distress.
Well, I've come from a performance of one of my works.
You're a playwright?
A composer, ma'am.
A composer?
In a tentative way.
And your work was performed in Salisbury?
At the Baron's Hall, yes.
Oh, then you must be famous. May I know your name?
Dargan, ma'am. Hugh Dargan. But there's no reason why you should know my name. This is only the second time that a work of mine has been professionally performed.
But what was the nature of the work this evening?
I call it a Wessex Rhapsody.
It sounds quite beautiful.
Well, it's actually a song cycle. Well, that's all I thought they could afford for a new composer. Pianoforte and tenor.
And the words? By whom?
By me, actually. Well, I couldn't find...
You're a poet, too?
Well, it's cheaper than paying royalties to someone else.
And the audience loved your work? They must have done.
They seemed quite enthusiastic, yes. Quite a round of applause.
How wonderful for you.
It really was, yes. The performers were magnificent. Magnificent.
And now you're going home to tell your wife and children of your triumph.
I'm not married. I have no parents. Only a good friend. And he couldn't be in Salisbury this evening. That's why it's so rewarding to share my pleasure with you.
I'm proud to be here to share in it. You live in Exeter, I suppose?
No, ma'am. In a little seaside village called Cricket Magna.
Cricket Magna? But that's where I'm going.
You live there? Surely not. I'd have seen you.
I was never there in all my life, sir.
Then you are visiting relatives.
My aunt, Miss Pendred. Do you know of her?
She has a large house overlooking the bay.
Yes, indeed.
Inspirit ist ein Rudat to see the morning star and all the dreaming stars lay on the last of all and nothing man could mar. I wandered then in springtime and drank the lively air and all at dawning were innocent and fair, were passionless and rare.
Good heavens.
Good morning.
How very nice to see you again, Miss...
Gleave, Anna Gleave.
How do you do, Miss Gleave?
How do you do, Mr. Dargan?
Well, now, anything particular in mind?
It's my aunt's birthday on Friday, and I really have no idea what to give her.
So you thought a book. Excellent notion. Well, any idea what her tastes run to?
I think discreet romanticism.
Ah, poetry, perhaps?
It's possible.
May I ask what kind of price you had in mind?
Well, 5 shillings.
capital. We should be able to find some well-illustrated volume of discreetly romantic poetry for 5 shillings. No doubt about that.
I think that seems absolutely ideal.
Tell you what, why don't you let me think about it for a while? Then I could call at Miss Pendred's with a selection for you to choose from. Well, of course, we'd have to keep our meeting dark from your aunt.
You're going to a great deal of trouble.
To sell a 5-shilling book, I'd walk to Lyme and back.
But then my love came riding all on a vessel gray. My love to me came riding with laughing voice and gay. And how could I gainsay?
Heavenly here.
It is. With the right companion.
You're very sweet, Hugh.
How much longer will you be staying?
I really think I shall have to leave at the weekend.
The weekend?
I'm certain I far outstayed my welcome. Poor Aunt Helen thought I was coming for a fortnight, and I've been here 6 weeks already.
Will you mind going back to London?
Of course I'll mind. London will appear... oh, hot and dreary after Cricket Magna. It's strange. Although I've spent most of my life in town, I always think of myself as a country girl at heart.
I expect your parents will be missing you.
Oh, they'll quite miss me, I'm sure. But we aren't a very demonstrative family. But Charles is fretting, I'm afraid.
Charles?
He and my parents tend to look upon him as... my young man.
But do you?
He's charming and attentive and rather handsome. And he does have 5,000 a year.
Good Lord.
Which makes him even more attractive to my parents. I fear that upon my return, I shall have to decide rather promptly to become engaged to Charles or to discourage him from paying his attentions altogether.
Are you telling me she's a liar? Because...
what I'm telling you is this. The young lady knows your crackers about her, and she knows you're inexperienced, and she knows you're a gent, and she knows you've inherited quite a flourishing little business.
You talk as if she's a fortune hunter. If she were after money, she'd have married this Charles ages ago.
Exactly. If he existed.
Now, dash it.
Now, don't flare up. You came to me for advice, and that's what I'm giving you. If you make no positive move over the next few days, I'm absolutely certain that the young lady will discover 100 reasons for delaying her stay just a little longer.
You're making her seem tawdry and calculating.
Tawdry? No. But calculating. Now listen, Dargan. Unless a girl has the advantage of a wealthy background, she has to be calculating. She has just a very few years in which to attract a suitable single man. And when she finds one who appeals to her, she has to spread her nets. I see nothing tawdry or dishonest about this young lady's talk of a wealthy suitor. It's simply her way of forcing your hand. They do it all the time, God bless them. Oh, another drink.
I want her. I want her desperately.
Perhaps. Or perhaps it's the physical experience you need. And you can obtain that for 5 shillings any time you like.
I'm not talking about desire. I'm talking about wanting to be with her. All the time.
Well, you're your own man. But if I were you, I wouldn't rush into marriage with the first pretty creature who fluttered her eyelids at me.
Thank you.
Olivia says here that she and Harrowwood are off to Paris in June. Oh, think of that, Hugh. Paris. Couldn't we afford to go to Paris just once?
Well, I can't say that Paris holds any attractions for me.
But what about me? I'd like to go. Have you thought about that?
Shall we talk about it again when I finish the partita? But honestly, darling, I can't concentrate on anything else when I've got a composition to hand.
But that's the trouble. You always have a composition to hand. And when was the last time you had anything performed professionally? 3 years ago?
You haven't lost faith in my work, have you? I mean, crikey, I'm scarcely 30. And plenty of composers have to wait far longer than that to achieve any kind of recognition.
Oh, Hugh, it isn't that I don't believe in you. You know that. It's just that what you like composing, other people don't seem to want to hear. More tea. Couldn't you, just for once, try something popular? Something that people will want to hum and whistle. Something to make your name known.
Not to Minnie Old Kent Road. Home sweet home.
There's no need to sneer at popular taste. It's what people want.
It's what some people want.
But you're always writing sad things. Why can't you think of something jolly and happy? Wouldn't you like to be remembered as a composer who made England happy?
I want to make you happy. If I can do that, everything else can go hang.
You do make me happy, most of the time.
Ah.
I want to be proud of you, darling. I want everyone to know that my husband is the best composer that ever was.
Or the most successful?
Now, that wasn't called for.
Oh, darling, darling, I'm sorry. Please be nice to me.
Eat your toast before it's stone cold. Will you be able to help in the shop today? The visitors are starting to arrive. Beth and I were run off our feet yesterday.
I was hoping to finish the second movement this week. It's been holding me up for ages.
But you have all evening.
Well, I know, but the fresh ideas come best in the morning, in the open air.
I see. So while I work till I drop for 12 hours, you'll be lying in the grass on Rimmer's Leap, smoking cigarettes and dreaming.
Anna, I promise you this. Just give me today completely clear, and you can have the rest of the week off. I mean completely off. Mrs. Ferguson can always lend a hand if business becomes too hectic.
Well, the trouble with Mrs. Ferguson is that she's flustered if there are more than 2 customers in the shop at any one time.
No one can deal with customers as you can, darling. Akers was only saying the other day that business must have doubled since you started working in the shop regularly.
Mr. Akerhurst. I don't care for that gentleman. I don't know why you're so thick with him.
Because I like him. Because he's an old friend, and I value his judgment.
More than you do mine?
Oh, come on, pretty one. It's a beautiful morning. Let's kiss and make up. I have a feeling that today, the muse will descend. Yes?
Damn it all, you old fool! Don't you recognize me?
Edmund Poe? Poe! Good Lord! What the devil are you doing here?
Come home to roost, me old cocker! First thing I did, I asked at the bookshop for you. That scrumptious wife of yours told me you'd be communing with nature on Rimmer's Leap, while she works her fair hands to the bone selling Bibles to Jew boys. Well, are you going to shake hands?
The last thing I want is to shake hands with you.
Hughie, you haven't changed. Not one iota.
Nor have you. Now, if you intend to stay here, I shall leave.
Not so fast, Hughie. You aren't going to run out on your friend quite so fast. Well, don't you understand? My first full day back at Cricket Magna, and my first thought was to seek you out.
Leave go of me. Let's get this absolutely clear. I was never your friend, and I'm not starting to be your friend now. The best thing you could do for me would be to drop dead this instant. The second best is to steer clear.
Is that understood?
What's the matter, Hugh? I've never seen you look so angry.
I understand that a man named Powell called at the shop today, claiming that I was his friend, and that you put him on my traces.
A man named Powell? The successful composer, Edmund Powell? Oh, darling, you never told me you and he were friends. How exciting.
We are not friends. I hate the man. I loathe him utterly.
Oh, what is all this about?
Powell is entirely evil, and has been so from boyhood.
Oh, how can he be evil, Hugh? He and I talked together in the shop for several minutes this morning, and he was courteous, merry, and so full of affection for you. How could such a man be evil? He thinks the world of you, darling.
Powell and I were at the dame school here. We were at prep school together, and we were contemporaries at Clifton. But he was always bigger and stronger than I was. When older boys bullied me, Powell would knock them down. What a price he exacted from me afterwards. He tormented me and humiliated me, and all the time proclaimed to the world that he and I were the closest of chums. Eventually I secured an open exhibition to Oxford, and thought at last I'd escaped him. But the moment that blackguard discovered it was to Oriel College I was going, he persuaded his father to buy him a place there. And then the whole hideous business began all over again. But this time it was worse. Just give me the bottle of whiskey, Saul, and a jug of water. Thank you.
So, what happened at Oxford?
Oh, it was atrocious. I was reading music, and Pearl began by reading greats. Then, when he discovered what I was up to, he turned, after half a term, to music. He couldn't take tutorials with me because I was an exhibitioner, but the moment he saw me in the junior common room, it would be beer all round, and what are you working on today, Hughie? Scratch the water in yourself, will you, Akers?
Here we are, humble and obedient.
I have to be frank. That awful swine did have some musical talent. He had a flair for finding a thumping good tune. Something that's always escaped me.
Oh, that isn't entirely
true. He had
the
common touch. He could write clever, bawdy songs for the June smoking concerts. Fellows loved them. Sang them under my windows, and I was slogging away at serious composition. I had these lovely rooms.
Isn't it time you went home? You're looking dreadful.
These lovely rooms and a fine pianoforte, and that ghastly swine would swagger in, sit down, light a cigar, and strum on my pianoforte. Obnoxious stuff. The kind of stuff that I would never, ever... Oh, I have to go. I feel awful. Akers, for God's sake, see me home.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning, ma'am. May I help you?
Mr. Dargan?
Yes?
I'm so pleased to meet you. I've heard so much about you from Edmund.
You are Mrs. Poe?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, how do you do? This is my wife, Anna. Anna, this is Mrs. Poe.
How do you do? It's extraordinary, you know, that we haven't met before. Originally, Edmund and I intended to marry at Oxford, and he vowed he would seek you out, Mr. Dargan, and insist that you be his best man. And then he was asked to sail to New York to supervise the production of one of his light operas there. So, we thought it would be very romantic to marry aboard ship.
What a lovely idea.
Oh, it was, in theory. But unfortunately, we were so ill during the crossing that the ceremony had to be postponed until we reached New York.
And since then, you've been living in London, I imagine?
That's so, yes, Mrs. Darwin.
And what made you exchange the excitements of London for a quiet backwater like this, Mrs. Pole?
Oh, it was for Edmund's sake. He's hard at work on his first symphony. He hopes to finish it next month.
How splendid.
Oh, I hope it will be. I'm sure it will be. But, although he's very busy, I'm insisting that we don't neglect our social obligations. We intend to hold a dinner party week on Saturday. And naturally, Edmund's oldest friend and his wife are at the top of the guest list.
A week on Saturday? The 24th?
Yes.
Then I'm most terribly sorry, Mrs. Pole, but we shall be unable to attend.
But Hugh, why? We have no idea.
Akers has asked me to give an address to the Artisans Educational Association over at Lyme Regis on the 24th. I accepted. I forgot to mention it to you, Anna. I really am most disappointed, Mrs. Pole, but I'm sure you'll appreciate that the AEA is a social obligation we must treat punctiliously.
Of course we must. And Edmund would be the first to agree. And there's no need for any disappointment, because he insisted that I should find an evening suitable to you both before issuing any other invitations. So, would you be free on Saturday the 31st?
You knew that rubbish about the AEA was an excuse. You knew I had no such appointment. You knew I was doing everything possible to avoid an invitation to Pearl's house. But you ignored my wishes and now we're committed. I shall plead a toothache on the night and not go.
I simply don't understand why you're behaving like this. How could you go on inventing lie after lie? And that charming girl, so enthusiastic with her diary. How could you snub someone so pleasant and gracious?
I have no quarrel with Mrs. Pole. I'm prepared to agree that everything you say about her is correct. I did like her. Which makes all the more incomprehensible her union with a monster like Pole. She's worth 100 of him, 1,000.
You're seeing the whole thing out of proportion. The few minutes conversation I had with Mr. Pole the other day convinced me that he was an accomplished and courteous gentleman who had only the highest regard for you.
If you tell me that once more, I shall... I thought I'd made it perfectly plain the other day. For some vicious reason, comprehensible only to himself, Pole delights in persecuting me. I'm not a gregarious man, but I have a small circle of friends whose company I enjoy. Have you ever once heard me utter a single word of complaint against them? Or about any other human being I know? Have you ever known me to be vehement or hysterical about anything at all until Pole returned? Have you?
No.
No. You grant all that to be true. Now, do you also grant that school bullies exist and thrive? Anna?
Oh, I suppose so, but that...
You grant the existence of bullies. Well, most boys, fortunately, grow out of that objectionable period of their lives. Some do not. Pole did not. His behaviour at Oxford was a great deal worse than ever it had been at Clifton, because he had far greater licence in every respect to indulge himself. Now, a successful bully in adult life can no longer rely on physical strength to dominate and humiliate his victims. If he tried that, he'd be up before the magistrates in no time at all. So, he has to use cunning. He has to discover what most wounds his prey, then use that knowledge to continue his persecution. Thus, Pole knows I loathe him. So, what more exquisite form of torture can he devise for me than to claim to me and all the world that I am his closest friend? If I don't complain, then I'm acknowledging a totally false relationship. If I object, people think me churlish, vindictive, or insane buffoon. Either way, he's won. Either way, I suffer. When we came down from Oxford, I thought, with profound gratitude, that I need never have to set eyes on Pole again. Slowly, I began to recover from 10 years of his cruelty. I met you, and my happiness seemed assured. And now that devil is back. 3 days only, and see what he's doing to our relationship, to yours and mine.
Darling, You said that most boys grow out of being bullies.
Yes, most boys.
Well, don't you think it's possible that Mr. Pole simply took longer to grow out of it than other people do? And that now, with success and fame and marriage to a delightful lady, he's matured? That he really does want to be your friend and make some sort of reparation for what he's done in the past?
Not him, not Pole.
I was greatly taken with Mrs. Pole. She's someone I should like to have as a friend. I don't have many friends.
But how can you form a friendship with a woman whose husband I detest?
I haven't asked you for very much since we were married. I've respected your need to spend nearly all your spare time on composition, and I've understood your natural need to spend some time in the company of Mr. Akehurst and the others. In return, I want us to attend Mrs. Pole's dinner party, as we promised her we would. And then, if Mr. Pole is the awful creature you make him out to be, I too shall see it, and do all I can to discourage him from any further intimacy with you, even if it means my forfeiting Mrs. Pole's regard. Is that very much to ask? Hugh...
Thank you, sir.
Dargan's Bookshop, Church Street.
Very good, sir.
What a delightful evening. And didn't Ruth look enchanting?
Ruth?
Oh, don't be so stuffy. Mrs. Pole.
On Christian name footing already?
You and Edmund have known one another for 20 years, and we're your wives. These are modern times. Oh, it was such a pleasant evening. And you must admit, you enjoyed yourself enormously.
For the sake of the company and our hostess, I played a cheerful ape. I wished myself a Botany Bay most of the evening.
I don't believe you. You're saying that because you know you were wrong about Mr. Pole, and you don't lose face by admitting it.
What you saw were the public faces, mine and his. Agreeable because it was socially necessary. What you couldn't see was his behavior at the dining table when you ladies had retired.
Oh, Hugh, you're exaggerating again. How did he behave? Don't shout like that. You may misspill the tea.
Confound the tea. Listen to this. A letter from my publisher. Sir Bentley Underwood wants to include my partita in a concert he'll be giving with the Wessex Symphony Orchestra in May.
Oh, that's wonderful, Hugh.
40 guineas. I shall receive 40 guineas. And if it attracts good notices, my publisher hopes to sell it to his counterpart in Munich. Oh, fantastic! Unbelievable!
Oh, darling!
For this occasion, and with 40 guineas to come, you shall have a new bonnet and gown for the concert, and I shall have a new frock coat.
Morning, Mr. Dargan. You're looking pleased as punch.
Oh, I am, Saul, I am. A time for celebration. What I really want is a pint of champagne and a dozen oysters.
Oh, then you're in luck, sir. We had a crate of oysters just in from Lulworth's morning.
Capital.
Dozen oysters, Pat!
Are you expecting Mr. Akehurst in for luncheon?
Well, he'll be here, sir, in full. That's his choice of a Wednesday.
That looks delicious, Saul. And what will you have?
Well, I shall say no to court out of mine, sir. Thank you very much.
Splendid.
Hughie! Last man on earth I'd expect to find here in the middle of the day.
Life is full of surprises.
What are you drinking, Hughie? I have things to celebrate.
I have all I need.
Need? What do you want? Saul, what's Mr. Dargan drinking?
Champagne, sir.
Champagne! Our tastes run parallel, Hugh, but didn't they always? And a bottle of champagne, Saul, and what's good to eat?
Well, sir, Mr. Dargan's having oysters and Lulworth.
Hugh, old soldier, how your tastes have widened, thank God. Oysters for me, Saul. 2 dozen to begin with.
Another 2 dozen, Bates.
This is how you generally take your luncheon, as a gentleman should lunch. Good food, good wine, good company.
Once in a very great while.
I can't afford champagne regularly.
But today is different. Different for me as well. I had such news this morning, Hughie. I shot round to your shop and Anna told me you'd be here. By God, she was right. You're the first to know. Apart from Ruth, of course. I had a letter from my publisher. Underwood is to present my first symphony with the Wessex Orchestra in May. It's to be the centrepiece of a programme of new work entirely by English composers. Hugh, I'm treading in your footsteps. We are inseparable.
Today.
You shouldn't be riding, Edmund. You're really rather drunk.
When have you ever seen me come off a horse?
I've never before seen you both drunk and on a horse.
I have had the most remarkable encounter today. I've been thinking about it all the way home.
Oh, you've been binking, have you? You went to the Shipwright's Arms. Whom did you meet there?
Chap I went to see. Old Hughie Dargan.
Oh, that was nice.
Hugh was celebrating too.
Oh, really? And what was he celebrating?
At least he began by celebrating. Then we heard what I was celebrating. Them in the ups and leaves without touching the oysters.
Really, Hugh, you're misunderstanding it all. Mr. Poe can have had no more idea your two works would be on the same programme than you did.
You didn't tell him?
I was going to, but the moment I told him where you could be found, he was off and away.
Poe arranged this. He's up to any mischief. Anything in order to embarrass me.
I am not going to humour you in this. No new composer can influence a major symphony orchestra in its choice of programme. You should count yourself lucky you've been included.
You don't begin to understand, do you?
I understand very clearly. You're jealous of Edmund. You've always been jealous of him.
Jealous?
Jealous? Jealous? Jealous?
To live with a man of creative talent is never easy, Anna. But Edmund always appears so sensible and happy and confident.
Ah, over his lighter compositions, his Boulevardier work, he's never lost a moment's sleep. But now, with serious work in hand, it's a different matter.
Oh, do come here, Scrap. And stop chasing butterflies.
Oh, he is a dear.
My pride and joy. Aren't you, horrid lad?
How is it different for Edmund these days?
Oh, my dear. He's worried himself sick over that symphony of his. I believe for the first time he's realized against what standards he'll be judged. And it frightens him. Well, comic opera successes come easily to him. But a symphony.
Hugh is being very difficult. He believes he'll be hopelessly outshone by Edmund at the concert.
That's absurd. Well, Hugh has always been a composer of serious and lasting music. And Edmund's a mere beginner there. He holds Hugh's work in high regard. He insisted on taking me to, would you believe it? To Durham Cathedral, when Lawrence Bennison was playing Hugh's A Wessex Rhapsody. Ernest Anderton was the tenor, and he sang beautifully. Edmund had tears in his eyes throughout. Anna, I'm certain the true laurels will go to Hugh's Partita. Although I've no doubt that Edmund's symphony will be competent and lively.
title of the programme. What an Edmund of a beast. Why aren't you congratulating him on the success of his symphony?
His symphony?
Why are you shouting? People are looking at us.
His symphony?
Are you ill? You look ill. You.
That symphony.
It was a triumph.
A florid, noisy maelstrom of sentimentality and ranting chauvinism. And you know it. There was only one. Anna, I was never more serious in my life. Listen to me. Of the four movements of that work, which did you find the best?
I don't know.
Which movement?
What the devil are you doing here? Alone.
Oh, my God, Akers, what a night. What a hellish night.
Hellish? Your partita was enchanting, delightful.
Was it? I didn't hear the performance.
You didn't?
Have you a flask with you?
Of course. You would never travel without it. But...
Oh, please, give it to me at once.
Dear boy, you look terrible.
Thank you. Thank you.
Where is Mrs. Dargan?
With them, with the Poles, celebrating his victory.
Go on, drink up. Colour's coming back, tragic.
Yes. Tell me honestly, Akhurst, what did you make of Pole's symphony?
It was popularist, noisy, not ineffective.
Was there anything in it that recommended itself to you as valuable?
No. Second movement, all strings, wasn't it? Seemed to be of an altogether higher order than the rest. If he could have sustained that level, we might have had a masterwork on our hands. What's the matter?
Akers!
Are you raving mad?
You agree that tonight was the first time you and I and the concert-going public have ever heard that symphony, that movement?
Well, naturally, first performances of all four works,
let
so...
Let me recapitulate that noble second movement for you. He called it a cavatina. It begins with a long cantilena passed from part to part of the strings, yes? But it's actually in a sonata form. The cello announces the melody, then the upper strings interrupt with descending phrases, then they take up the cello's theme. And it's all in E minor. The second subject consists of 32 bars of a completely harmonized melody in E flat. We have no development. Merely a substantial section in or around A minor, and the first violin is what we recall. And in the last subject, there's a revival of the earlier melodies and a coda, in which the solo cello alludes to the middle section and ends in E major.
This is extraordinary. Your musical memory is extraordinary.
My musical memory goes back not to an hour ago, but to 9 years ago, to my rooms in Oriel. But I was working on a serenade for strings.
Clearly, this all means a great deal more to you than it does to me.
My last year at Oxford, when I should have been revising continually for final schools, I was spending far too much of my time on a serenade for strings. The university was offering a very attractive junior fellowship in music for the best work for strings composed by an undergraduate. And I'd almost finished my serenade. I knew it was good. For the first time, I had absolute confidence in a composition of mine. But I was very tired and stuffy. I rode out one Saturday morning to the Cumnor Hills to clear my head and my heart. I stopped off, I remember, at some village inn, drank old ale. Never had the world held so much promise or so much beauty. My cup was overflowing. When I returned to college, and slightly in my cups, I went to my rooms.
Your lovely rooms. Yes, yes, go on.
I went to my desk and opened the drawer that contained the manuscript. I wanted to look at my serenade, to revel in it. And it was gone.
Yes?
We're closing early this evening.
Oh, really?
We're visiting the Poles.
We are what? What are you up
to? The fact is, I've been underestimating Poles' many talents for far too long. Time I made that plain to him.
Whiskey.
What a good idea.
Isn't it? Isn't it always?
And the ladies?
Oh, out on the lawn somewhere, playing with Scrap. Mrs. Dargan appears to be very fond of that erratic little beast.
I believe she is, yes.
Ah, thank you. So, what did you make of the notices?
They still prefer your German composers to your homegrown ones, it seems.
Yes, true. But they weren't entirely damning.
No. No, I can't say they were.
Look here, Hughie. Why are you here this evening?
Does the olive branch alarm you?
You know very well that my house is your house, old lad, but after... Well, it did come as something of a surprise to learn you'd be calling this evening.
The fact is, I wanted to talk over old times.
Old times?
How old?
Oxford.
Oriel.
Oh, yes.
Any particular reason why? Do you recall that terrible hullabaloo in Trinity 83?
Our last term, then.
There were so many hullabaloos, old swaddy, and I started most of them.
But this was one I started.
About the theft of my manuscript?
No, I can't say I remember.
Well, I'd been out all one Saturday morning. I returned to my rooms in the afternoon, opened the drawer to take out my most significant manuscript, and it was gone. My serenade for strings had gone. And only a fortnight to final schools.
You hadn't made a copy?
Oh, don't be ridiculous. Whoever makes a copy of a first draft?
Do you?
Trouble was, I'd really burned my boats with that serenade. I desperately wanted to stay on as a graduate after final schools. To do that, I either had to take a sure first or win the junior fellowship in music with a serenade. I neglected my revision. The serenade was stolen. And I finished my Oxford career with a poor second. Scuppered. All ends up.
But if you thought your serenade was so good, why didn't you get your nose down the moment schools were over and wipe the damn thing out all over again?
Because my father died at the end of that June, and my mother was quite incapable of running the business, our only source of income. In his last illness, father had let things slide tremendously. It was almost 4 years before I could think about anything else but the bookshop, and then I wrote a Wessex Rhapsody.
Why not the serenade?
Every time I remembered its theft and what I'd lost through it, I became so angry I was incapable of serious composition. It had to be something different. So, the Rhapsody, then a string quartet, then the oboe concerto, and finally the partita. I've always been best with strings. Odd thing is, I felt when I'd finished the partita that I'd exorcised my old insane anger over the serenade, and I was going to have a go at it. Until the concert on Tuesday.
The concert altered your plans?
Oh, yes. Because my serenade was performed on Tuesday night, although it turned out to be the second movement of your symphony. I must say it stood up very well. Very well indeed. Good enough for that junior fellowship.
It's a mellow evening. I shall take a stroll along the cliffs. I'll send a cab for Anna.
You're saying that I stole your manuscript and used it in my symphony?
Anna's told me that Mrs. Bowle told her that you made a specific point of keeping up with any public performances of my work. And the serenade hadn't made an appearance when you were agonizing over your symphony. And you are an established composer. Of sorts.
You've got hold of the wrong end of the stick altogether, Hughie. I heard your works because I've always admired what you've written. Damn it all, I dedicated the symphony not to my wife, but to you.
Well, in the circumstances, that seems pretty fair, doesn't it?
Oh, Edmund, You're sure you didn't have a terrible argument?
My dear girl, I've never known him so calm and self-possessed. And he gave us his only reason for leaving alone that he wanted to stretch his legs along the cliffs.
He's behaving so strangely these days.
He is. That's why I welcome this opportunity to have some private conversation with you. Oh, come on, girl. Trot on.
Did he make any reference to your symphony?
He told me, with all the charm in the world, that I'd stolen a manuscript of his when we were up at Oxford and used it as the second movement of my symphony.
And that's what he told me outside the concert hall. He was like someone demented. That's why I was afraid he'd come to cause trouble this evening.
No trouble, I assure you. Well, no raised voices or physical threats. He seemed almost amused.
I'm terribly worried about him. I'm certain he's going to have some kind of breakdown if things continue like this.
Do you know what I think? I think that when he came back from his ride that Saturday afternoon in Trinity, he went to his rooms, sported his oak to keep out intruders, then re-examined his serenade for strings, and I believe he suddenly realized that it just wasn't up to snuff. And he was desperate. I heard some of the serenade, you know. I'd hear Hugh trying it out on his piano when I was in the quad below, having a beer with the chaps. It was charming, certainly. Neither inventive, nor in any way mature. So he destroyed it. And to enlist the sympathy of the senior common room, he put it about that it had been pinched. I mean, really. Who on earth would steal a fellow's work? Oh, raggings, yes, no end of those. But theft? At Oxford?
If that were true, it would explain why he never tried to rewrite it afterwards, as he would have done, would have to have done, if it had been something of value.
Exactly. Exactly. He cut his losses, poor old boy.
Oh, Edmund, you're so understanding about this. I so value my friendship with Ruth. And you. And I couldn't bear it if it was spoiled by some awful, unnecessary quarrel.
You know how fond I am of Hughie. And I hold you in the highest esteem. You're an oasis in the desert of Dorset. If ever things become too much for you, you know where your friends are to be found. Come on, Nancy. Trot on, girl. Trot on, won't you? I found it, Akehurst. I found the key. And it's this.
Shh, think of Saul's license.
Oh, sorry. It's this. In the past, whenever Pole stuck his pin into me, I yelled. And that's exactly what he wanted. But this evening, when the pins went in, I smiled and ignored them. And for the first time, he didn't know where he stood. He didn't know what to do. Henceforth, the more he talks of our friendship, the louder I'll champion it. Until in the end he'll tire of it all and shuffle back to London in search of fresher game.
Hugh? Hugh, you know how fond I've become of little Scrap. And I was wondering if I might buy a puppy. I'd look after him, of course, and take him for walks, and train him. I shouldn't expect you to be worried about that sort of thing, but I really would like to have a nice little dog about the place. Hugh?
I'm listening, sweetheart. You'd like a puppy. Why not?
Oh, you mean it? Oh, thank you, darling. There are some 8-week-old Cocker Spaniels for sale at a farm near Lulworth.
All right. It's early closing. I'll hire a trap and we'll drive over there directly after luncheon.
Oh, you are sweet to me, Hughie.
Hughie?
Well, sometimes you do look like a Hughie.
Oh, this was a good idea of yours. It really was.
Well, we both deserve some time off. It was too glorious to be spent within doors. I've had enough of dispensing potions and panaceas to the hypochondriacs of Cricket Magna. And they say the ale at Abbotsbury is remarkable for its thirst-quenching properties.
I'm as dry as a bone already. When shall we be there?
Oh, half an hour at most.
But if we stride out, rather less.
Oh, hang on the slack there, Dargan. Look here, I'm going to call you Hugh. I'm 30 years your senior, and dash it all, I've known you all your life.
Do you want a breather?
I wanted a chance to talk to you. About Wakely and Peveril and the rest of the clan of the Shipwright's Arms being within earshot.
Oh, yes. Talk about what?
Do you trust me?
My dear chap, what on earth?
If there's one precept I've always tried to observe, it's this. When someone approaches me and says, I don't like to say this, but I think you ought to know, I turn on my heel and walk away. And if that's what you feel inclined to do in a moment, who am I to blame you?
I'm all agog. Do tell.
Very well, then. I believe that Edmund Powell is determined to seduce your wife.
I'm sorry.
Your wife has a dog. She exercises him at Rimmer's Leap.
Yes?
Powell takes that dog of his to Rimmer's Leap also.
Oh. Not his wife?
You go to the Shipwright's Arms perhaps twice a week, never less. You arrive after you've dined, and you stay till midnight or thereabouts. Then often you come back for a nightcap with me or Peveril.
So?
Your habits are so regular that I have good reason to believe that Pearl and Mrs. Dargan have been meeting at Rimmer's Leap by night this summer, whilst you were with the rest of us in the sky. I lay the blame almost entirely at Powell's door. He's a philanderer. There's nothing he likes better than a serious challenge to his charm. Mrs. Dargan is presenting that challenge.
Oh, God. Oh, dear God.
I ride upon in autumn. His laughter burns my head. I ride a tar in vengeance to see the foeman dead who chose to soil my bed.
Inspector Lovelock will see you now, sir.
Thank you.
Dargan, sir.
Good day, sir.
I've come to talk to you about the disappearance of Edmund Poe.
I did wonder how long it would be before you paid us a visit, Mr. Dargan. Thank you, Sergeant. That'll be all for the moment.
Sir.
You have heard the prisoner admit, gentlemen of the jury, that on the evening of November 21st last, he clandestinely climbed down from his study and under the cover of darkness made his way to Rimmer's Leap, there to await his unfortunate victim. He has told you he remonstrated with Mr. Poole, pleaded with him to end this alleged affair with Mrs. Dargan. But Mr. Poole became violent and the prisoner at the bar was obliged to defend himself strenuously. And that, in the course of a short scuffle, Mr. Poole lost his footing and plunged over the edge of the cliff, never to be seen again. This is the tragic misfortune the prisoner alleges. Now I ask you, gentlemen, I appeal to your frank good sense and experience of this world and its ways. I ask you, would the unhappy participant in a tragic misfortune have left it unreported? Would a decent, honest man have crept back to his home, climbed stealthily up a wall and into his study,
Would he minutes later have lain beside his wife and said nothing? Would he have lied to his wife? Lied to his friend, lied to his staff, lied to the wife of the missing man, lied to the police, lied to the entire township hour after hour, day after day, week after week, for 3 whole months, knowing the agony of mind the missing man's wife was undergoing. Are these the actions of a man who knows, in the sight of God his maker, that he is innocent of premeditated murder?
Dorgan, your visitor.
Ruth.
You may sit, ma'am.
Thank you. May we not be alone?
Certainly not, ma'am.
Why have you, of all people, come here? And now...
Because you've consistently refused to see Anna. Why won't you see her?
What purpose is to be served by her coming here? It would only distress her, both of us. She has more than enough to endure, in all conscience.
But she's your wife. She wants to comfort you.
I'm a man under sentence of death. What can comfort me now? Except a reprieve. Ruth, believe me, I did not murder Edmund. Counsel and I expected all along that the harshest possible verdict would be manslaughter. I was prepared for 10 years' hard labor. But execution. And on presumption only of his death.
Oh, Hugh, the Crown had legal precedent for that, I'm afraid.
Of course. They were after my neck, and they've got it.
But there's still possibility of a reprieve. You mustn't give up hope.
The moment Edmund came back to Dorset, I knew my life was ruined. Look here, you see the way my thoughts run. What on earth made you undertake this ordeal of visiting me?
You're the gentlest man I've ever met. But I am certain you did not murder Edmund. I believe that once you had some regard for me, despite your open hostility to Edmund, a hostility that caused me great unhappiness for a time. But because of that regard, which I reciprocated, I couldn't bear to think of you, in addition to your other sufferings, suffering also in the belief that I hated you for what you did.
Had things been otherwise?
Yes. Had they been otherwise.
The world and Anna believe me utterly neurasthenic about Edmund's persecution of me. They believe my story of his theft of my serenade to be a vicious slander. Do you?
Edmund was many things. Masterful, exciting, inventive, physically alluring. Sensitivity of the sort that produced that music was alien to his nature. But it's in everything of you.
Oh, thank God. Thank God you believe that. Do you believe that he and Anna were intimate?
Anna can't entirely be blamed. When Edmund wanted something, someone, he was irresistible. He achieved me. He kept me, even though our natures were so much at variance. I knew that from time to time he kept mistresses, but he was discreet after his fashion. He couldn't resist philandering. It was part of his nature.
You must have had an awful life with him.
Awful? Not really. I had a pretty fair idea of what he was like by the time I married him. But I couldn't resist him. He craved excitement, and he created excitement. And it could be overwhelming. Life in London with him was so full of events. His musical shows, other people's first nights, parties, dinners, dances. And the gambling. Sally adored gambling. He was generally successful. And when he was successful, he was generosity itself. Nothing too fine for me. But he also had this need to achieve more than wealth and popularity. He needed recognition as a serious composer of the first rank. That's why he enthused about your work so much.
And since he couldn't better me, he plundered and destroyed me. This is all quite appalling for you, dearest. You'd better go. Where are you living now?
Well, the village became intolerable, as you can imagine. I'm living in Penzance under my maiden name, with my godmother, Gwendolyn Folliot. She's a remarkable woman and a very good friend to me.
Will you ever think of marrying again? You must. You're young and you have so much to offer.
I think it unlikely. I've only ever cared about two men in my life. Others would be shadows to them. One was Edmund, for all his deceits.
2 minutes late now.
Thank you, I'll remember that.
Oh, Ruth, I thank you with all my heart for having the courage and the grace to visit me here, to talk to me so frankly.
I shall pray for you every day. Goodbye, Hugh.
Think of me if ever you should hear the Partita again. You're constantly in my thoughts when I wrote it.
God bless you, my dearest.
Tomorrow my husband hangs, Inspector, and you are responsible. What propriety is there in seeing me now?
It's because of the circumstances, ma'am, that I felt I must call on you. Won't you sit down?
Thank you. No.
It may be of little consolation to you, but I want you to know it gives me no satisfaction, no professional pride, to see the turn of events in this case.
Indeed. I thought it was your job to send men to the gallows.
I apprehend criminals, ma'am. I do not try them, nor do I convict them.
I repeat, what do you want with me?
Your husband, of his own free will, gave himself up to me. Of his own free will, dictated and signed his confession, a confession he did not later contest in court. Once that confession was made, the justice, we must all acknowledge, undertook his trial and his sentence. But I'm certain your husband was not of stable mind when he encountered Mr. Poe that night. Had this been France, I've no doubt he would have been acquitted by virtue of the nature of his provocation. You must understand, my beliefs and my opinions are irrelevant in a court of law. Only my evidence may be required.
Provocation? So it's your belief that Mr. Poe was a plagiarist, and your opinion that he and I committed adultery?
Proof is not necessary to provoke a man to the rash act, ma'am. Suspicion alone will suffice.
I think I shall sit down, Inspector. Would you be good enough to pour me some brandy?
Oh, of course I will, of course I will. But Mrs. Darwin, what for pity's sake have you stayed on here so long? In this predicament, the notoriety and the unpleasantness. Will that be enough?
Thank you. The notoriety has had people flocking into the shop as they never flocked before. They want to see the scarlet wife of a condemned man, and they pay for the privilege. They buy our books. Has it ever occurred to you how much the legal fees for all this horror have been and will be? How could I have afforded the best possible counsel for Hugh, even though he failed, without my earning my living here, in the only way I know how, by playing to a gallery of prurient fools?
private, harms better in private.
Officer, is this good news at last?
I think so. Don't you, Anna?
Edmund? Edmund!
That night on Rimmersley, we staggered around, flailing. I told him to stop being such a fool, and then I lost my footing. Down I went, yelling. I hit a thick bush about 30 feet from the summit. It was pitch dark, and I was scared and winded. It took me hours of terror to scramble back to the top.
But where did you go after that? Why not straight home?
I wanted to give Hughie a fright. He'd nearly done for me. It terrified me half to death, and I decided to pay him back in his own coin. So, before dawn, I was on my way to a certain cottage that you know well, my love. I intended to lie low for perhaps a day while Hughie informed the police and search parties were organized. And then, when he'd suffered enough, as well he might, I'd put in an appearance and talk of temporary amnesia and have my hands round Hughie's throat for the rest of his life.
You're insane!
But as hours mounted into days, into weeks, and still no statement from your husband...
He hangs this morning!
For what he justifiably believes to be my murder.
I have to tell the police! A telegram to Dorchester! There's still time!
Oh, no! We waited out.
Edmund, I beg you.
Don't beg. You know it infuriates me.
You can't let him hang. You can't.
Don't you understand? This is the supreme moment of my life. To have you die on the scaffold while his wife lies beneath me.
No!
We shall hear the bells of All Saints strike the hour, and we shall celebrate. I've loathed him for 20 years because he was so good. He couldn't help it. A living reproach to me. Year after year. He never strayed, not once. His lessons were good. His life was good. And his music was good. And I loathed him for it. While I had my easy successes, he went his lonely way and created such things as I could never dream of.
Dancing leaves they call me, the scaffold stands on high. In hanging time they call me, the chaplain's eyes are dry. I look once at the sky. The trap falls.
Darwin.
Yes.
Is it true that the Home Secretary has commuted the death sentence?
Mr. Acast? Yes, it's true. I have confirmation by telegram this morning.
Thank God. Oh, thank God.
In view of the circumstantial nature of the evidence, and because of Hugh's many months of imprisonment prior to the trial, the Home Secretary has commuted the death sentence to one of penal servitude for life.
Mr. Akehurst, you will spend the rest of his life on Dartmoor.
Mr. Dargan?
Inspector Lowe?
I have such news for you, sir.
He said he would kill me if I moved.
So the hour went by, and as far as you knew, my neck was broken.
What could I do? He was far stronger than I.
When did you learn of the reprieve?
Directly after 8. The boy from the post office came directly after 8.
And when was Hull's body discovered?
A few hours later. That's when Inspector Lovelock called round. He said...
What did he say?
He believed that Edmund, having thought you were hanged, suffered a sudden excess of remorse and cast himself over Rimmersley before he could hear the news of your reprieve. Why are you looking at me like that?
Did Pearl tell you why he never revealed his earlier survival to his wife?
He despised her, he said, because she was so weak and suppliant.
So he came to you?
He said he wanted me because I'd never yielded to him.
And that was true?
Oh, dear God! I married you! I love you.
How could it have been convenient for him to disappear so completely and for so long?
He told me that he'd lost a great deal of money on the stock market and a great deal more in gambling.
Now be quiet, damn you!
The gambling debts were obviously waived on his surmised death. His insurances took care of Ruth. And when he was working in Portugal a few years ago, he opened an account at the Lisbon Bank. Privately, he sent at least half his royalties there. He had a villa somewhere on the Algarve, where he said he could live like a grandee for the rest of his life. An incognito.
I don't believe a word of it.
You...
No man who would let me lie in jail for 15 months in an agony of suspense. No man who would allow me to go through a 3-week trial for his murder. No man who would allow me to suffer under sentence of death while appeal after appeal went up and were rejected. No man who could return to the place of his supposed death and keep under restraint the wife of the man who was due to be hanged at 8 that morning. No man who could do all that. Then walk directly to Rimmer's Leap and throw himself over the edge. Let the dog in. This is no doing of his poor creature. I'm sorry I've got it.
That's what Inspector Lovelock believed. That's the only explanation there can be.
Simple Simon met a pipe.
Is this?
Telegram from the Home Office could not have arrived here after 8. The Home Secretary, once agreed upon my reprieve, would never be so inhumane as to let you believe I was hanged and then have the telegram delivered.
Edmund was outside the shop, knocking on the door when the telegraph boy arrived. Edmund said he was my cousin, calling to comfort me, and that he would deliver the telegram. He bribed the boy with money and charm.
And when you thought I was dead, he gave you the telegram. Edmund had something in there.
It was then that I knew.
How did you lure him to Riverview?
I don't want to talk about it. I never want to talk about it. He was evil. He was a monster. And now he's dead. Oh, for God's sake, Hugh. Let's do what you once thought of doing when Edmund first arrived here. Sell up and go to London and start afresh.
But the knowledge will always be with you. Wherever you go,
I thought I killed him. And for a time I rejoiced that he was dead. But day after day, the knowledge of what I'd done haunted me until I could think of nothing else. And so, after far too long, I gave myself up.
We can't go through that horror again. We can't let Edmund take his revenge twice. You know I became his mistress, didn't you?
Yes.
And this is your way of punishing me.
If you go to the police today, now, with all the circumstances clear and horrifying in people's minds, there's no jury in the world that will convict you of murder. There'll be universal demands for your release. And if you leave it, as I did, only the memory of that one act will remain, and you may well hang. If you decide not to go to the police, I shall leave you immediately, and you'll never hear from me again.
Oh, can you be so pitiless?
I shall ride out, Orton. I must lose the stench of the condemned cell. When I return, I expect you to have made up your mind, one way or another.
Hugh! If I should agree to go to the police.
Then I'll stand by you until you're through with me.
And I'll do it.
Have I anything to offer you in return? What you needed is a flamboyant and self-assertive man. And you found one in Edmund Floyd. What I needed was a woman who would support a precarious and modest enough talent and love it for what it was, not for what she chose to do.
Oh,
the last 2 years have crippled me. Probably forever. All I want at the moment is to let the public forget me and the mystery go. And to know that in whatever direction I ride, no walls will intervene.
And where shall I go?
To the Aljava. I'm certain Ruth will never claim that Sunday Carol. Live there like a grand beacon. And the incognito.
Has our life together meant nothing to you?
Nothing but the slow erosion of the mystery.
I destroyed those in you.
Oh, no. It's in the nature of things. Is there anyone? Even our Redeemer himself. We have not suffered the war that we produce.
There's time yet for a decent happiness together. You.
Half measures.
You!
In Silver Mist was written by Michael Robson, with music composed and directed by Anthony Smith Masters. Colin Baker played Hugh Dargan, Angela Phillips, Anna Dargan, Patrick Malahide, Edmund Thole, Sarah Benfield, Ruth Thole, John Westbrook, Mr. Akehurst, Bill Wallace, Inspector Lovelock, and Crawford Logan, the counsel for the prosecution. Martin Hill was the tenor, and Anthony Smith Masters, the pianist. In Silver Mist was directed from Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.